Ask anyone around today's waterfronts for the names of some historic designers, and I'll bet my dictionary to a bus ticket that the first to be flagged up will include William Fyfe, J.L. Watson of George V's Britannia, and Charles E. Nicholson. The association of these giants with the great yachts of the Golden Age before World War II made them famous beyond the tiny circle of privilege who paid for their commissions. They were also table talk in humble households who could never hope to tread the decks, yet who willed His Majesty to win as they watched the racing from seaweed-popping rocks and wind-swept piers. In reality, such big-name draftsmen in their world would have had little to do with most of us. The designers that YM readers might have looked to in those days were a different breed. Some were amateurs, and in a generation where excellence and self-control were taken for granted, they were none the worse for that. My personal favourite is an eye surgeon called Harrison Butler. Running him close for sweetness of line and balance of helm came Linton Hope, Warrington Smythe, Norman Dalymore, and Albert Strange. I don't know why we never hear mellifluous names like these any more, but if the Prime Minister really wants us to discover the essence of Britishness, he might take the time to consider such men. Their stories may have varied, but these artists in the discipline of the drawing board and slide rule had one thing in common. They knew how to make a small yacht beautiful. To lift so potentially humdrum an artifact to the level of high art takes education, study, and years of application. Maintaining their standards on the water is the duty of every sailor, even if our boats are brand new and have no more sheer than this morning's paper. Given a halfway decent shape, a yacht's excellence is established by the sum of 1,000 details, which is where the rest of us come in. Take boot topping, for example. That line, painted fore and aft just above the waterline to divide antifoul from topside colour. Harrison Butler made a point of picking out this vital boundary on his plans, and it is never parallel-sided. The upper edge describes a shallow parabola whose arc lies partway between the flat lower waterline edge and the sweeping sheer line of the deck. The difference between his curving boot top and the ruler straight equivalent often seen today is little more than an inch, yet it brings the yacht to life. Like Mother Nature, the classically styled boat hates a straight line. Many modern cruisers, on the other hand, have a flat sheer. This leaves the designer little option but to mirror it, but if she has even the hint of curve in her deck line, a touch of movement in the boot top can work miracles. The same goes for painted sheer strakes, those bands of colour along some hulls that cheat the eye and make them appear lower slung than they actually are. In the days before fiberglass construction, one plank would be picked out for just the same reason. So why did the wooden boat look so much better? The answer is that a hull plank tapers naturally towards its ends, generally from its lower edge. The paint line was defined by this taper, and however slight it was, it drew the eye upwards to follow the sheer. The shape of the whole boat was enhanced. A parallel line can do the opposite, flattening the sheer and killing any curvature the deck may have stone dead. A cove line whose aft end dips down is disastrous for the same reason, yet more than one well-known manufacturer foists this horror on new owners today. Another area of forgotten subtleties is the rig. Except in certain specific cases, traditional sail plans with two or more masts went to some pains to keep the spars parallel when viewed beam on. A ketch or a schooner with her masts sagging outwards at the top looks, not to put too fine a point on it, like a half-split log. Yet every day we see two masters suffering this gross indignity. It shouldn't take much to put it right, and the yacht will positively sing her gratitude. Boom angle does a lot for a yacht's appearance too. Older style rigs favoured mainsails cut with the boom well down at the gooseneck, sweeping upwards to the clew. This followed the sheer, and in the days of low freeboard it kept the sail from rolling into the water downwind. Check any photo of an old pilot cutter, or one of those American masterpieces like Ticonderoga, and notice how today's open 60s have reverted to type. If ever you see such a yacht with her main boom sagging like a door with the top hinge off, find her sailmaker and insists he stops humiliating so fine a vessel. Modern cruisers with flat sheers and high freeboard have no choice but to rig the boom parallel with the water, but many could at least be lowered to a more natural height. The occasional bash on the head for the unwary would be a small price to pay for improving the general view, lowering the centre of effort, and allowing the sail to be stowed without a garden ladder. Let's end with the spreaders. When the Almighty invented these, he intended them to bisect the capture-out angle at their outboard end. This slight upward kick delivers maximum efficiency. It also lifts the whole boat visually, like a bird flexing her wings. Stuff the spreaders square across the mast, and the spar somehow loses both height and grace. An inch or two is often enough. On G.L. Watson's Mighty Britannia, you might be looking at a whole foot. But Harrison Butler and Linton Hope weren't designing for kings.